look up and lift up your heads. We'll see. That's what Luke 21:28 tells us that we have to do, and that's the subject of this symposium in two parts. So, there is a precursor to this looking up. It says, when these things begin to come to pass, then look up. So let's take a look at these things. Luke 21:28 was part of Jesus' final discourse when he said, you know, what to expect between his advents. And we can find them summarized. Volume 4 does a very good job of summarizing these, and I'm going to be referring to some of the material there. But it really is in kind of three parts. The part you see in yellow here is a part I'll focus on, which are the events signaling the close of the gospel harvest. That's this Luke 21:24-7. Prior to that time, Jesus talked about the events of the gospel age up to the harvest period and the harvest of the Jewish age. And remember, in there, important thing was saying, you know, part of this understanding was to be able to go back and forth between the two harvests and figure out what comes where. This one, however, is easy to look at as Luke 21:24-27, the events signaling the close of the harvest. And I'm going to suggest those events can be categorized this way. This is a categorization I made, an outline of the Battle of Armageddon, Volume 4. It lists all the chapters in that volume, categorized in five different categories you'll see here. The religious world, the political world, the social world, the financial world, and Israel. Because those are the five elements that we deal with as we get to the end of the gospel age and the period of the harvest. So this is for your own reference, and obviously you're not going to go through every chapter, but this is the way I want to organize these things that we see come to pass. So let's start with the easy one. Let's start with Israel. Unless you've been blinded or in an institution for the last few years, you know how Israel is in the news. Jesus said back in this Luke 21:24, that one of the things that would signal the close of the gospel age harvest, it would start when the treading down of the of Jerusalem would continue and be trodden down to the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. That was a key event that he suggested around this period of the harvest time. If we read it from Moffat's translation, 21:24 says, Jerusalem will be under the heel of the Gentiles till the period of Gentiles expires. Similar language, but you get a little better flavor for what that means. If someone's under your heel, you know, in the days when the enemies, when you'd conquer your enemy, once you got them, you'd put your heel on their neck and hold them down. And that's kind of the picture here, that Jerusalem, Israel, would be under this heel of the Gentiles till that period expires. So when we look at the times of the Gentiles, primarily we're dealing with the time and nation of Israel. Although it incorporates a little more than that, but that's the primary focus. And that's what it comments in Volume 2, page 73. There's a comment introducing this idea of the times of the Gentiles. And here the pastor says the term times of the Gentiles was applied by our Lord to this interval between the removal of Israel's kingdom, the typical kingdom, and the kingdom of Israel, and the introduction of what he called them the antitype, the kingdom of God. So the application in the literal days when Israel was removed as a dynasty, and the time when the current period of Gentile dominion over the earth would be removed to be replaced by God's kingdom. The time when the glorified saints would be together and that kingdom would be inaugurated. And he suggested that the Gentile governments exercised authority over Israel, both fleshly and spiritual. And that's why we look at both aspects, although, as I said, primarily we're dealing with the nation of Israel, but there's also a spiritual aspect, and that's what incorporates the other four elements that I suggested in these the categorization of this volume. Well, it certainly was true with Israel. Remember what happened when Jesus was removed from the scene? Some years later, 70 AD and 135 AD, two wars pretty much wiped out the nation. destroyed the temple, kicked all the Jewish people out of that area. That's when the name got changed to Palestine, to forbid the Jews to enter Jerusalem except one day a year, the 9th of Av. Still a national day of mourning with Israel. They rebuilt Jerusalem, the Romans did, and they gave it a Roman name, Aelia Capitolina, so to wipe out any sort of memory of Israel. And all the nations just kind of took turns occupying it. Even the Muslim occupation, you hear now about ISIS wanting to create a Levant. That Levant was part of that Ottoman Empire that controlled all that part. So when you use that term, Levant, I can't help but feel insulted that they're talking about the dominion over Israel, which no longer should exist. But anyways, that's really what happened with the times of the Gentiles. So what do we see as the first sign of the expiring of the Gentile times? 1878, a significant event took place, the Congress of Berlin. If you read the Jewish Encyclopedia, this is what they'll say about that one-month Congress in 1878. In several instances, the Congress made the grant of full civic and political rights to Jews a condition for recognition of independence of Turkey, and it has therefore an important bearing upon the history of Jews in the southeast of Europe in recent times. First indication, coming right at the time of the harvest period. Of course, that was the time we started to see the fulfillment of many scriptures. Amos 9, 14 and 15. I'll restore the captivity of my people Israel, rebuild the ruined cities and live in them, plant vineyards, drink wine. Importantly, the underlying part, not again be rooted out from their land. That's one of the signs that was there for Israel, that the Gentile times were expiring. It's a time of the harvest period. One of those things that were coming to pass. Well, we could talk a lot about what happened in Israel, but let's jump to one event that's happened in our lifetime, just less than a decade ago. In 2006, Israel reached a real milestone. After the Holocaust of World War II, there were only two centers of life really that remained for Jewish life, because they'd been expelled from just about every place in Europe. One was America and one was Israel. In 1990, the Jewish population in the U.S. was 5.5 million. In 2000, it was 5.2 million. Israel's Jewish population in 2006 passed 5.6 million. Today, it's just over 6 million. That's the Jewish population, not the population of the country. But when we hit 2006, it exceeded what was in the United States, that 5.2 million. It's the first time, brethren, since that second war, 135 AD, that now today there are more Jews in Israel than in any other country in the world. Is that significant? I think so. Let's move to the next category, the religious world that we see. Part of this prophecy that Jesus gave said there would be in the earth distress of nations with perplexity. The powers of heaven shall be shaken. Now, heaven, of course, we recognize as ecclesiastical heavens, not the literal heavens up there, but the ecclesiastical heavens, those that represent God. So it says, when they are shaken, then will come this second aspect, the glory of the Son of God. In the foreword to Volume 4, Brother Russell made a statement. This is saying that all the kingdoms financially weaken. I'm going to skip that for a moment. The necessity for keeping a dominating grip upon the public and preventing anything akin to socialism and anarchy. They will look to the great religious institutions to support them, to help keep the ship of state from being overturned. And then this statement, already they are rolling together as a scroll, the one side Catholic, the other Protestant, opposed and yet connected, each side united and federated to the best of its ability. We've seen some significant moves of trying to bridge this difficult gap that exists in the general world of Christianity. One of those happened in 2009, the Catholic Church and the Anglican Church. Anybody read about Henry VIII? I'm Henry VIII, I am. You know. Well, yeah, remember, he left the Catholic Church because he wanted to be divorced and marry. So in late 2009, there was a publication of Anglicanorum Coedibus, which was the Anglicans were invited into unity now with the Holy See, the papacy. That action was as a response from the Anglican side to be received back into full communion with the Holy See, but yet keep their own identity. And that was an agreement that was reached. Is that kind of rolling together as a scroll? They're not one scroll, but they're certainly rolled together. Recently, in Italy, we've seen a huge Protestant consolidation. You know, more than 90% of the Italians, 57 million of them, are Catholics. At least in name, they are Catholics. But there are 65,000 members who said, you know, we're in a great minority. Maybe if we get together, we'll have a little more power. So the Waldensians, the Methodists, the Baptists, the Evangelical Lutheran churches, they came together and formed a federation of Protestant churches in Italy. Well, they were 100 years or more late after other federations were formed, but here they said the only way we're going to get power is to come together to a certain degree so that we can represent this aspect. 1994, 20 evangelical and 20 Catholic leaders signed Evangelicals and Catholics Together, the Christian Mission in the Third Millennium. Doesn't that sound like a great paper? But what did that document say? The document said, look, we've been fighting each other for a long time. Let's work together. Let's walk together. Let's oppose humanism, relativism, all those things that are outside of the Christian beliefs. And hey, let's stop trying to proselytize one another. Quit the witnessing. Let's work together to keep this thing going. People were willing to give up the freedom of thought that they had in order to survive. Recently, just 2 years ago, 2013, a monumental thing that almost went unnoticed, and I couldn't understand why more didn't see this event happening. But in January 31st of 2013, Roman Catholic Church and a group of Protestant denominations signed a document to formally recognize each other's baptisms. Now, that was never, baptism was one of the sacred things, but yet they're recognizing each other's baptism. So I think all these things show how the cooperation to survive has driven behavior from the churches. Even the Islamic group, the Islamic Cooperation Group, back in 69 this started, and you wonder why ISIS has been allowed to grow up in the midst of Islam. September 25th, 1969, they lost the Six-Day War to Israel. So 57 member states get together and say, let's safeguard and protect the Muslim interests of the world. And they did that by signing an agreement treaty. And that's why you're not seeing the kind of Islamic reaction to all the jihadists that exist, because they're committed to a cooperative spirit. Well, let's turn to the political realm, where we see significant events in our day as well. Not too long ago, Gretchen and I watched a show on the History Channel. It's called The Sons of Liberty. I don't know if any of you saw it, but it was about the pre-revolutionary period. And, you know, one of the great pre-revolutionary people was Samuel Adams. Not like he was portrayed in this show, but, of course, they have to dramatize it. But the idea was they were very committed to trying to improve the conditions under which they were oppressed. Volume 4, Brother Russell wrote this, and I think this is very significant in terms of seeing how certain blessings occur in our own midst. He wrote this about the U.S. He said, no other country could the blessed harvest message, the plan of the ages, and its times and seasons and privileges have been so untrammeled in its proclamation, so widely, freely heralded. It was, we believe, for this very purpose that the providence of God has been in a measure over this country. There was a work to be done here. He says, when the hand of oppression sought to throttle the spirit of liberty, a Washington was raised up to lead the impoverished but daring liberty lovers to national independence. Then later, he says, when the time had come for the liberation of 4 million of slaves, God raised up another brave and noble spirit in the person of Abraham Lincoln, who struck off the shackles of the enslaved and preserved the unity of the nation. That's from page 145 of volume 4. But the point was, leaders were groomed and blessed by God to do a work that would be the precursor to establishing the point of truth. What's happened 100 years later? Henry Kissinger, I think, was a great Secretary of State. I love reading the things he wrote. One of the things he wrote in his memoirs, The Years of Renewal, I think summarizes what has happened since those days, and this is similar to what we see of happening in the religious and the political worlds, or the religious and the social worlds. Let me read you a little bit of an excerpt from his book. He said, "The great statesmen of the past saw themselves as heroes who took on the burden of their society's painful journey from the familiar to the as yet unknown. The modern politician is less interested in being a hero than a superstar. Heroes walk alone. Stars derive their status from approbation. Heroes are defined by inner values, stars by consensus. When a candidate's views are forged in focus groups and ratified by television anchor persons, insecurity and superficiality become congenital," which means chronic. Isn't that a summary of where we are in the world today? It's not about the value that's inside. It's about what will the people think. Let's turn to the social realm. Zephaniah 3:8 says, "Wait for me, declares the Lord, the day when I rise up as a witness to gather the nations, to assemble the kingdoms. Earth will be devoured by the fire of my zeal." The gathering of nations is a great social event of our time that points to this very issue of preparing the world for the intervention of God. I thought this is an interesting chart, and I'd like some of you more technical people to explain to me what this is. This is from the World Economic Forum 2013. It's their Global Risk Interconnection Map. What it shows is the risks that are inherent, and each of those represents a different country and a different failure that would impact the world. So the blue and the green and all those. But if you ever wanted to talk about interconnectedness of the world and the gathering of nations, this is it. Here's the top five global risks as assessed by the World Economic Forum. Major systemic financial failure. Failure of climate change adaptation. Global governance failure. Water supply crisis, critical systems failure. We saw that in the cyber terrorism. These are risks pulling the whole world in, not one country, not nationalism. Let's turn to the financial realm. In the 1916 foreword, Pastor wrote this, "The nations are falling into the chasm of bankruptcy. But it is with them as with a human being falling. The sensations are not so bad until the falling ceases in a demoralizing concussion." Now, we used to say, it's not the fall that hurts, it's the sudden stop at the end. And that's really what we're saying here. Is the pastor thought this was going to be the big impetus that leads the world into the major disaster. There was a recent study by Greenlaw Hooper Hamilton Michigan investment firm that said when a country has more than 80% of their public debt to their gross domestic product, that's all the goods and services that they produce domestically, when their public debt is over 80% of that ratio, it's a point when that nation becomes vulnerable. What do we mean by vulnerable? Investors that buy the bonds, the debt of that nation, want higher interest because there's more risk. That adds to the debt burden, and that cycle is a vicious one. And its end is not pretty. It's either really high inflation like happened in Germany after World War I, or it's the ultimate, which is default. We saw that happen in Greece. Well, here's a look at the debt of the public debt of nations, what we call sovereign debt. That's the debt of all public and private that's owed to non-residents. Okay, those that are not here, because we always say, well, what's wrong with debt? We own it ourselves. These are not treasury bonds and bills. This is sovereign debt. You look at each one of those, and you can go down the list from Ireland all the way to Canada. Remember what I said, 80%? Well, every one of those is in a vulnerable position. What does that mean? It means that regularly you got to roll this debt over because you got to keep financing it. And you create a popularity contest. If you watch reality shows or know anything about them, every week somebody gets voted off the show. Well, that's what happens. Every time they roll this over, they got to get a public vote every week. When they fail that vote, remember that's what happened with Greece in early 2010, and again they had to get renewed because it didn't help, it plunges that country into a crisis. That's one of the greatest risks we have, and the bigger impact when that crisis hits. If we had time, we could go into some of the elements of the plagues, which I believe one of those plagues is a drying up the river Euphrates, which represents the financial means of the world. And that plague is the next to the last Armageddon. Well, we've looked quickly in a whirlwind tour at these five elements and hope you can see the difficulties in our day of what we have to say. We were led into this harvest period by seeing the nation of Israel no longer being trodden down. And as we survey the other elements, we see the difficulties that have arisen just in the last 100 years since that happened with Israel. In the conclusion to the 1916 forward, my conclusion, in the 1916 forward, Brother Russell laid out in that forward, I think, 10 key events. These are my summary of his 10 key events. As the blessings increase, discontent increases. Happened. Wealth compounds at unprecedented rate. $2 trillion in 1900, about when he wrote this, $241 trillion in 2013. That's a pretty good compound interest rate. Improved labor conditions have increased discontent. That's happened. Increased knowledge has added to the discontent. That's happened. The nation's vying for equal prosperity is happening all around us. The conflict between the haves and the have-nots continues. Today, 10% of the people in the world own 86% of the wealth. And as I mentioned, the nations fall into bankruptcy due to increased debt. I've circled that because the elements are there. Worldwide revolution due to the discontent. Some of the things we see cooking out there certainly point to difficulties. And the last two, he says, nominal religion rises in influence and the complete eviction of Gentile rule, overturning of Babylon. There is some question on number 9. Some brethren believe this will happen. Others say not as much, but regardless, we can see their fight for survival going on. And yes, number 10, at some point, the complete eviction of Gentile rule. We're 80% of the way through this list, is the way I look at it. So this is what Paul says in 1 Thessalonians. People will think they are safe and secure, but destruction will suddenly strike them like the pains of a woman about to give birth. In that forward, pastor says, the Lord will allow mankind now to go to their length in carrying out their own plans and schemes. He'll allow them to demonstrate the futility of these schemes. He will permit the wreck and then reorganize. That's an important principle, brethren. We'll let the world go as long as they can. He will permit them to wreck, but grasp it out of disaster. Not going to let the world blow up, but it's going to come as close as it can so that they know there was no way out. So for us, let us be a student of prophecy, not a prophet. This shouldn't be our primary focus. We should be aware of what's taking place in the world around us. And that's what I hope we've been able to point out in this summary. But don't be over attentive. We've got a lot of work to do on ourselves and a lot of work to do in the meantime. Jesus summarizes at the end of this discourse he gave by saying, be on guard. Why? So that your hearts will not be weighted down with dissipation and drunkenness and the worries of this life. So that day will not come upon you suddenly like a trap. The ignorance that people had going into the ark, when Noah was going into the ark, we are not to be ignorant of. But don't let your hearts be weighed down so much by it that you miss the bigger picture, that this is the Lord's launching of the inauguration of His kingdom. And so we come to the final element, the question asked at the beginning. Luke 21:28. When you see these things come to pass, look up. Why do you look up? Well, she's pretty happy getting a shampoo, isn't she? When you put your head down and you shampoo, what happens to the shampoo? Runs in your eyes. Now we got tearless shampoo. When I was a kid, you just started crying. Okay? But if you look up, you have no problem. Runs off the back. When you look down at your earthly problems, you overweight the cares of this life, just like the leaders do of our world. So for us, when you look up, brethren, you let the spiritual side, the spiritual awareness come into your life, and that's the focus that you have. So brethren, always look up.